Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is a town hall to try to explain some of McGill's financing to the community and the situation in which we now find ourselves. And the title, I think, more or less sums it up. It's yet again a new challenge that we're facing with regard to the university's finances. I want to put this in context. There are several questions that have been sent to the Office of the Provost, the Office of the Budget, the VP Admin and Finance, or to our communications group, and they had to do with what was perceived to be a slight contradiction between what the principal said in September, which was we were not in a crisis, but where are we now? And I'm still not going to define it as a crisis. We have a difficult financial situation that we have to address, but it is not a full-blown financial crisis. We've faced those in the past. This one is difficult, and it's going to require effort, but it is not yet in crisis proportions. It's different than other setbacks in a number of ways. 4 years ago, we understood that there was going to be a recalculation of just how much money the provincial government would be able to put into higher education, along with its other requirements such as the healthcare system and infrastructure developments, as well as education at levels below universities. But this setback is different because of the nature of the announcement. It's coming to us a bit late, and it's promising to be even worse next year. So I wanted to just underline that we're in a situation that we were not prepared to face initially, but for which we took some precautions, and I'm going to come back to those. The ministry is announcing that notwithstanding the fact that they have delayed their announcement of the budgets that would be made available to universities, they nonetheless expect us to finish the year with a balanced budget. I'll come back to the way in which they communicated that. Someone actually wrote and asked, why doesn't the university have a rainy day envelope? I guess we've been living through too many hurricanes to have that envelope still preserved. But we actually run a deficit budget at McGill, and we have for some time. And a deficit budget means that if you were to run a surplus, and we did a bit last year have a surplus, it just goes to reducing your total cash indebtedness. It doesn't have the effect of being there, sitting there, waiting to be used for another purpose. And we're trying to address the issue of chronic underfunding of universities from our perspective, not by criticizing the Quebec government for trying to be responsible in managing the public finances, but rather asking them to set us a bit free and give us more flexibility to address the issues ourselves. Because if you can't give us funding, we have been telling them, then at least let us raise revenues in a different way. So the context for this has to do with the way in which the finances for the university, the funding in particular for this year, came to the university and what our expectations are for next year. It's not, again, not the first time we've faced shortfalls, but in the way in which they've been announced to us, this does create a somewhat unique situation. I want to get some terminology straight, because those of us who are not, and I include myself in that, who are not financial people, sometimes have a difficult time understanding the numbers that are sometimes used to describe how the university's finances appear. There are two or three different ways, maybe three or four different ways, in which you can look at them. The first is we have an operating fund at the university. It's one of four funds that comprise the total picture of financing at McGill. The operating budget comes to us in a variety of ways, and I'll talk about the revenues in a minute, but it is generally unrestricted. It means we can use it for those things that we think are most important, like paying your salaries, right? That's an important thing to do. It's considered unrestricted. There are three other funds that the university has. One is a capital fund or a plant fund that can be used only for physical modifications of the infrastructure that we own. So it's a plant fund for renovations and potentially for new buildings. And it is an extremely restricted envelope. in the Quebec government grant that they give us, money can flow from the unrestricted operating budget into the plant fund, but money in general can't flow from the plant fund into the operating fund. So it's a one-way permeability of those funds. The third fund we have is a research fund, and that is a large amount of money that comes into the university every year, but it is controlled by individual professors or research teams. And the university can't just use that money for other purposes. The research money is entrusted to the university, and we have to guarantee that researchers actually use the money for the research for which the money was committed, but we cannot use the money for other purposes at the university. So we can't use it to give professors or staff salary increases or even hire new professors. Individual researchers can hire people off of those soft funds, but those are not available to the university for other purposes. And the last fund is the endowment fund. And here we do pull some money from the endowment every year. The endowment is now over $1.2 billion. And we pull right now about 4.25% of that into the operating budget of the university, but most of it is earmarked for very specific purposes. It's used for scholarships, fellowships, it's used for bursaries in some cases, and it's used for those endowed chairs, it's used to cover a portion of a professor's salary. So there's an operating budget component, but it's not that we can take the $1.2 billion and use it for other purposes. Just to be clear, $1.2 billion would allow us, if it were totally unencumbered, to operate the university in the absence of any other revenues for just about a year. That's about it. So it's a nice thing to have, but it is restricted. When we prepare a budget for the university, we do it in the winter and spring to have it available and to start on May 1st. So the fiscal years that we talk about are fiscal years that start on May 1st and end on April 30th. But think about that for a minute. If the budget year in which you're living closes on the 30th of April and the new one starts on May 1st, you don't have your audited financial statements yet. You don't know exactly how you ended the year. So it's based on a lot of assumptions. We make assumptions all the way through in terms of understanding revenue streams into the university and expenditure streams out of the university. So the fiscal year 14 ended on April 30th, 2014, and fiscal year 15 started on May 1st of this year. So we have to keep those two dates in mind. We ended fiscal year 14, started fiscal year 15, 30th of April, 1st of May. And we didn't have year-end closing on the actual financial statements of the university. In addition, we didn't have real budget rules from Quebec. I'll talk a bit about that later. Another thing is, when we talk about the operating budget of the university, we generally mean what all of us truly understand. You know, it's money in, money out to operate the university on a year-over-year basis. But there are things called generally accepted accounting principles which deal with the overall assets and liabilities of the university. And those are much bigger. They involve a lot more than just the annual flow of revenue into and out of the university. There's long-term debt, like the bond issue that we have had for the last decade and which will end 32 years from now. We have responsibilities for the pension fund that we sometimes have to put an infusion of cash in, although recently we've been sharing that responsibility with employees. And there are some things that are not included in the gap, but which we know we have to fund, like the big deferred maintenance bill that this university is facing. So remember that operating budget is different than gap, although it's a part of the gap, and the fiscal years don't give us enough time to actually know what the situation is when we ended before we already start another one. In fact, the financial statements of the university were only, the audited financial statements, were only presented to the Board of Governors at the beginning of this month. So that took us from the 30th of April to October to have closure on fiscal year 14. Now, let's go back. And remember, the fiscal years are from April to May, or May to April. So the budget book is presented in the early spring, late winter, early spring, and we projected a possible $10.4 million deficit on our operating funds, and therefore to GAAP as well, right? It's part of GAAP. It's not all of it, but it's a part of it. And those audited financial statements instead showed a surplus of $15.7 million. That's a big swing, right, from a potential $10 million deficit to a $15 million surplus. The point, we'll come to the crux of it here, is that we had a possible, we were given the opportunity of running a deficit of up to $10.4 million if certain financial situations appeared, but we didn't have to run a $10.4 million deficit. When we finished the year, in fact, $3.2 million, one accounting has it at $4.3 million, and I'll come back to that. We have multiple ways of actually slicing at the year, but $3.2 million was a cash surplus. And that cash surplus was used to reduce our operating deficit of about $100 million to just below that, 96.8 or something, right? So we reduced our operating deficit. In addition, there's a total GAAP deficit of the university, which when we started was $287.2 million, and it was reduced by that $3.2 million in cash surplus and by a $12.5 million accounting change to the market value of the pension fund. So that's a paper value. It was not ever in the university's operating budget, and it was never budgeted for. It was a GAAP adjustment to the pension fund. So when we have a cash surplus of $3.2 million compared to a potential deficit of 10.4, what accounts for those swings? Well, you've got some idea already. I gave it to you. We don't know exactly where we ended and where we're going to start, so that's one issue. And then there are factors that do weigh on providing positive variances. For example, we had higher than expected yields on students. And those student numbers and the courses that they take change the grant that the Quebec government gives us, and it changes our tuition revenue. So slightly more students leads to higher tuition and grant revenues from the Quebec government. It's bad enough that we don't know what our financial situation is at year end before we have to start another budget. But the government continues to recalculate what it thinks it owes us from previous years. And so in the fourth quarter last year, we received a huge infusion of $10 million or so from the Quebec government that was basically monies owed to McGill for previous rounds of submission of students and the grants. You can't count on that. And just because the government says we could accrue it and put it into our financial statements doesn't mean our external auditors will let us do that. So it comes in literally as a windfall when it comes. And what it goes to is, again, as I said, to correct the bottom line. You can't use it if it comes in late. Another thing is that we have been encouraging units to think more creatively about revenue streams. And last year, Management Institute, the Executive Institute and the Faculty of Management, School of Continuing Studies, and the Faculty of Medicine all had positive results on the sale of goods and services, in addition to the sales of goods and services that we usually have on campus, like the bookstore and selling parking spaces and selling or renting rooms to students, et cetera. So there was a higher value on those. And in addition, as I just pointed out, there was a nice $12.5 million swing in the book value, the market value of the securities that go into the pension fund. So that's the positive swings. There also were some negative swings, but they were by far offset by the positive ones. So then we move to fiscal year 15. And here, when we tabled the budget in April, we thought there would be $769 million in revenues, of which $361 would come from the Quebec government grant, not tuition, the grant. Okay, and in addition, that grant, for those of you who don't know how it's calculated, it's basically calculated on the teaching that we do. So if a student is a full-time, the full-time equivalent student gets a certain value, and then the activities in which a student engages gives us another value. So a student who's studying in arts, let's call it, we're in arts, but gets a factor of one, and a student studying in agriculture gets a factor of 4.2. So that means a class of 25 students in agriculture generates the same revenue as a class of 100 in arts, right? So the revenue are based on where you're studying. And if you go up a level to master's, then you get a multiplier, usually about 1.75. And if you go to the doctorate, you get another multiplier. So all of McGill's problems could potentially be solved if every one of our graduate students were enrolled in a PhD program in dentistry, which has got the highest possible value. The operating expenses were estimated to be $776 million, leading to a potential deficit of $7 million. So we were thinking that at the beginning of this year, if we needed it, we had a margin of $7 million. And these allocations started on May 1st. And they were prepared with the best available information that we had, including something that are called the orientations, or orientation, for the budget that's given to us by Quebec. And this is their kind of general line. We think we're going to have this amount of money for the system, and we think it should go into these envelopes, and here's what we think we can give you. So we use that as an orientation for how we budget. But that orientation can change, and in fact it changes at least two times every single year in terms of the way we get the grant from the Quebec government. But because of governance at McGill, the budget has to be approved by the Board of Governors through the finance recommendation from the Finance Committee. So they approved the budget with a potential $7 million deficit, and on May 1st, all the allocations that we thought we would make were made. This is how we thought the revenues were going to come into the university, and you can see the 361 on the to your right, $361 million expected operating grant from Quebec, representing about just under half of our total operating budget. And then the student side, which is also predominantly controlled by Quebec, was another 33% of our budget. So that's this is the business we're in. It's higher education, it's about students, right? Whether it's grant money from the government or tuition revenues, that's the single biggest source of all of our revenues. We get about $25 million from the federal government for indirect cost recoveries for research activity, but that's at a fairly low percentage. It's 17 cents on a dollar at McGill, so that's not a lot of indirect cost recoveries. And that's the sales of goods and services were another 15%, gifts and bequests about $6 million, and short-term investments were going to yield another nearly $5 million for the university. So that's how the picture comes together for the expected operating revenues. The expenses, which in this case sum to more than the revenues, most of it goes to salaries. If you add academic salaries, administrative and support salaries, student aid and salaries to students plus benefits, you're closing in on $3 out of $4 of the university's budget goes to pay for people. So, which again is, it's a labor-intensive operation. This is the industry in which we find ourselves. Now, I said before that we get an orientation of our budget from the government, and we would love to have the actual budget rules, the règles budgétaires, before we actually do our budget, but this is not the case. We got the budget rules on the 3rd of September for a budget that started on May 1st, and that was 4 months into the exercise of fiscal year 2015. And then we saw that the grant that we were going to get from Quebec, instead of 360-61 million, was 345 million. That's about $15 million less than we had anticipated. In addition, for the, I can't say the first time, but for one of the few times in this otherwise unrestricted fund, restrictions were placed on the way the cuts were made. So there was a 2% cut in admin salary mass. I want to keep that in mind. It's not how many people, it's how much you pay them, right? So the salary mass for admin would be cut by 2%, and 3% of all non-instructional expenditures. And again, here we have to know what are the non-instructional expenditures and which of the admin and support staff positions would be used. This is based on a third budgetary submission that we have to make. The first is the budget book. The second is the financial statements. And the third is the rapport financier annuel, the RFA, that we have to produce for the Quebec government, which has slightly different line items than we're used to using in either our GAAP or our operating budget presentation. So we have to keep moving things to fit into those. And it's based on those that they expected a specific line item cut. Now, in practice, they cut the budget already. So we could ignore it and just go on doing our business and try to keep it as unrestricted as possible. But we know that next year they've promised more of the same. And that means they're going to look at those line items again. And if we haven't made an adjustment, they'll cut it again. So it's a game, a mug's game, in which we, once they get into your line items, you have to be careful to obey the rules. In addition, in October, Vice Principal DeGrappa went to one meeting, and I represented the principal at another meeting, in which the minister and the deputy minister and the assistant deputy minister announced that the cuts for fiscal year 15 are not over. So we already knew that they had cut us, you know, on the 3rd of September, and then they said, but these cuts for fiscal year 15 aren't over. Well, how much are they going to be? Somewhere between $25 and $75 million for the whole system, which for McGill, if they did it proportionately, would translate to somewhere between $4 and $12 million. So what's the worst case scenario? We need all $7 million of the deficit that we had approved by the Board of Governors. They cut $15 million out, and they cut another $12 million out. You can do the arithmetic as well as I can. That comes to $34 million potential deficit in a single year, which is one-third of the total deficit that McGill has accumulated over 195 years. Right? So that's the worst case. We don't think it's going to arrive at that, but they also pre-announced in that same meeting that fiscal year 16 would be more of the same. And I don't think that meant, none of us, at least neither Michael nor I, interpreted that to mean that we have to just hold our own and they'll give us the exact same grant. It's more cuts are coming in fiscal year 16. They didn't tell us the amounts, of course, and they didn't tell us the line items. So trying to manage any variances, let alone negative variances, halfway through a budget year is extremely difficult, and it's made more difficult when we know that there's no relief in sight, because we don't have the flexibility we need to raise revenues even more, notwithstanding the fact we did very well on the sale of goods and services. That's a small part of our budget. So everyone knows we have a mission statement and we have priorities, and those priorities have to be the guide that help us through these financial difficult times. There were more questions. How are we going to respond to these cuts in fiscal year 15? So one question that came, and all these questions came from different sources that were compiled by either my office, Michael's office, or communications. But one of the questions was, have the savings from the voluntary retirement plan put McGill in a better situation to deal with these funding cuts? The short answer is yes. It's clear. We took the bad tasting cough syrup, right? We did it, we took it early, we didn't ask for any relief from the government, we didn't change our budget year to accommodate it, we didn't submit a second budget. We said, you cut our budget. Remember, the 3 years ago, they cut our budget by $57 million in basically an 18-month period. We had $57 million less in revenues. We adapted, and the voluntary retirement program was one of those adaptations. And it did leave McGill in a relatively sounder position than other universities in the system. It might sound surprising because we complain about underfunding all the time. We're still underfunded. But we took serious measures to try to address a shortcoming in the budget that was, we felt, not ever going to be corrected. So if you're not going to get the $19.3 million annually back into your budget, if you're not going to get the tuition increases that had been promised back into your budget, then you better take the message and cut your expenditures proportionately or find alternative sources of revenue. So we did that. And so we have complained less about these cuts than other universities in the system. Our neighbors across the mountain, which is that way, have in fact been complaining very much more than we have, and now having to admit that they probably made some miscalculations of their own in just how big the cuts were. But the cuts are real, and we have to deal with them, but we have a more solid base. Right now, we have no plans. We've allocated money to units. We have no plans of clawing back that money, but we are going to place some restrictions on how it can be spent, because that's the only way we're going to be able to manage this budget. We have made promises that have to be kept, and there are reasonable expectations based on our priorities that we're still going to invest in our future. We can't just close ourselves into our shell and hope that everything around us is going to get better. We have to make it better. So we're going to keep our strategic plans, our mission, and our aspirations alive, but develop a reasonable and responsible action plan. We are analyzing now, for the first time in a long time, ourselves analyzing budgets and allocations, expenditures below the level of faculties or VPs units. We're going to individual units and looking at some of the expenditure patterns that are there. So we have some opportunity in the budget. I want to go back for a second and show you that. In this budget, we have something labeled special projects, $9 million. Those were projects that we said we would undertake if and only if we got the funding. Well, it's pretty clear we didn't get the funding. So that's a cushion. That is a cushion in the budget. It's there. When we presented it, both the Senate and had it approved by the board, they knew it was there. There are some ways of saving money, even when you've allocated all of it in the budget. But this is now in this budget, right? So we have, in fact, had some of that money which was set aside as contingent on finances being available. So that's another reason why I'm not interpreting this right now as a major financial crisis for the university. If we have a cushion, we can use it. It's not everything. We have to make some additional sacrifices, but it's there, and we have to postpone some spending as well. So there's some other items in the budget that would be nice to do this year if the money is available, but if the money isn't available, we may be able to postpone that spending into the future. So we're doing our analyses very carefully to see if we can not spend any of the contingencies and also postpone savings in the short run. Another set of questions that came up. We have to already, those of you who know or have spoken to your deans or the financial officers in your faculties and units, know that we're already meeting about fiscal year 16 budget. We're living through 15. We don't have all the information in, but we have to prepare the 16 budget because it has to go to governance at least three times, an orientation, a first pass, and a final budget. So we have to prepare that now. And someone pointed out that since 2009, McGill seems to have chosen to implement budgets that were much more austere than those of other Quebec universities. And I think I've told you I think that's right. We have been much more cautious, and we're trying not to run up huge deficits. We're trying to be responsible because we don't know when things can turn around. Quick thought. We have $100 million in what we called a finance deficit. At under 2% interest, that's not a big burden on the operating budget. But if interest rates go to 4%, it will start to eat away at our ability to do other things. We'd still rather not have a deficit if we could, but if we have one, it's better to have one when the interest rates are low. And we've used it to make investments in McGill's future. So we know why we have an accumulated deficit. We have asked the Board of Governors, and they've given us permission to run deficit budgets, but not as big as those that have been run by our other U15 research universities in this province, but bigger than the deficits that are in other U15 universities in Canada. In many provinces, universities are not allowed to have a deficit. We are, and we've used it to try to remain competitive. We have to address some of the cuts now because we've been told they're coming. So it would be silly to put our head in the sand and ignore it. Cuts in 16 will be coming, so we have to plan. We have to hold on to what we have by positioning our deficits more or less in the middle of the Quebec pack, because if we became the only, if we were the only Girl Guides and Boy Scouts in the province and had a perfectly balanced budget, and then the government gave relief on deficits, we wouldn't benefit. If we had too much of a deficit, we risk being told you don't know how to manage the finances of the university, so we have to do something more drastic. So we're positioning ourselves pretty much in the middle. But there are going to be clear financial implications for administrative units, faculty, schools, and departments. We have to develop a budget that will require a reconsideration of revenue assumptions. The government has already told us they'll be going down. And also of our anticipated expenditures. And we're going to need consultation. I think that's what these town halls are really for. It gives us a chance to hear from the community about what might be done. I'll give you a quick example. When we had the first round of some of these town halls a couple of years ago, we asked people what could be done, and someone suggested spending money to save money, which was putting in intelligent light switches throughout the university to save on the electric bill, and we're beginning to see that investment is paying off. So that's a positive feature that was put into place, and there are others that we can find. Another thing that we think we know is the government is serious in the public function directly, but also in those institutions to which it gives a subsidy, that it wants to control growth in positions. They haven't told universities that we have to stop growing our academics. They've told us you have to reduce the size of your administrative and support staff. They've told us that by the 2% cuts. They've told us that by Bill 100 several years ago. It's a continuing theme with them. They want to see those reductions. It doesn't help, by the way, on the other side of the ledger, to have some professors at other universities, I haven't seen any from our professors yet, but they might be there, which are saying, well, professors don't teach enough. Professors should be teaching more. A professor at McGill has three roles. The academic duties include teaching and supervision, but it also includes research. Because go back to what I said before, that $25 million a year that comes into the university comes through indirect cost recoveries on our annual federal research funds. There's other money that comes into the grant from Quebec research funds, and there's overheads that come in through research contracts. So research is an important contributor to the university's identity. It affects our reach, our reputation, and eventually our revenues, because if we don't have a good reputation, students might not come, and then we get into a downward spiral. Or we can't attract the best professors, so we don't get good research results, and so our reputation suffers. So it is clear, however, that the government wants cuts in salary mass, and they've targeted administrative and support staff salary mass. And they've given it to us in line items, 2% of the non-instructional. Again, does that include people who are in the family of jobs that we have here at McGill called student affairs, or doesn't it? Is it too, it doesn't, by the way, just to answer the question, but it does have implications for the support that we could give to professors who are trying to conduct research and teach their classes. A university needs a balanced labor force, but the government is imposing some serious restrictions on us in that regard. Now, that has pretty direct consequences, but another question that we got was how to connect the dots between the high-level information that we give, either myself or Michael DeGrappa give, and then the local realities, and whether or not decision-making about these things can be made more transparent. So anytime information becomes available, we've tried to communicate it. The principal in September, Michael and myself, earlier in the month, and now through these town halls, we'll tell you what we know. What we know is not always very pleasant. I guess misery loves company, so I'll give you what I'm hearing is not that pleasant. But we're going to need to restrict spending. And only in January will we know whether or not our fiscal year 16 budget makes any sense at all. I usually would be going to the Board of Governors with an orientation to our fiscal year 16 budget in November and come to Senate with an orientation in December, but I'm not sure we can do that this year. We just don't have enough information. But we do know that our primary objective for fiscal year 16 rather, will be to minimize the effects on our academic programs, which, as I just said a moment ago, is the source of our reputation, our reach, and of course also our revenues. So we have to take some immediate steps. So for administrative and support staff positions, we're going to put a freeze on new searches. We have here new searches for external hires, but there are mechanisms that need to be studied. So we're going to have to freeze positions. We cannot afford to keep searching for new positions right now. Second, all reclassifications, and we know these are important. People have been asked after the voluntary retirement program. Admin and support staff have been asked to take on different duties and to reconsider the work that they do in their own offices. It's not fair that they should be then burdened with not having an opportunity to be reclassified. We are not restricting reclassifications, but we are asking for a second review of them to make sure that we're not just adding work, we're actually thinking about work differently in each unit. There are certain things we've been doing that we simply have to stop doing. So we shouldn't just add them to the job descriptions of individuals and go for reclassifications. Let's think carefully about that. We also have to postpone all non-essential equipment and furnishing purchases from the operating funds. That's 1A through F on research grants. That's still permitted if you can buy them. We have to limit travel and hospitality spending to a minimum, and we have to stop all in-year allocations, that is to say, from other contingency funds. The budget had $9 million in special projects, but there's also a $6 million contingency fund, and we don't want to transfer that unless it's a true emergency. So that's another cushion to try to end the year well. We'll reconsider all of these actions in January when the situation clears. And the reason you need to take concrete action immediately and without much notice is because if you have availability, and I put in parentheses there, false availability, right? We thought we had certain revenues, we distributed them to units. But we don't have the revenues. But we're not clawing them back. We're simply saying, for these kinds of items, don't expend, all right? And we also want to make sure that we avoid unpleasant interactions with the ministry at year end, and if we don't take the actions now, it's just going to make fiscal year 16 that much worse. There were many other questions that were raised that we didn't put into the presentation directly, but which are important. We know that the VRP has been difficult. 256 positions across the university are not easy to absorb. The loss of 256 positions are not easy to absorb. But we've done it, but in the last couple of months, we've seen two things happening. Where budget availability has been, where there has been budget availability, the salary mass has gone up over $1 million in the first quarter. And in addition, the replacement rate, which was supposed to be two people leave, one person gets replaced, we're actually seeing in those units that had budgetary availability, one person leaves and 1.6 positions are being created. So the local level has availability of resources that are now being used in a way that we didn't anticipate. We don't think that this is the way to handle the cuts in the long run. We're going to need to work with human resources and the VP Admin and Finance to redefine the workplaces at McGill in a way that makes sense given these budgetary realities. Right now, the hiring freeze is limited to admin and support staff because all the searches that have been launched for academics have already been launched. There are no new ones that come between now and the spring. So the once we said you've launched them, we're not launching anymore, and we'll reconsider our position for academic hires in the fiscal year 16 budget. And we don't expect that we're going to build a budget as if we had the resources to pay all the salary increases that have been promised or negotiated. So we're building the budget around along those lines. If there isn't enough money, it means more cuts somewhere else in the system. But it's not fair for people to continue to forego pay increases. There's likely that these will have an effect on students. We can't increase tuition or fees without either referenda or permission from the government, but that means that some services will have to be cut. We don't have enough money to provide student organizations with additional funding for even legitimate matching for the things that they've put up. We don't want it to affect our classrooms, and we don't want it to affect graduate funding. But deans, chairs, directors all have a role to play in helping to identify different ways of doing business and helping us to save some of those expenditures. We're a very ambitious university, and we're not doing badly, notwithstanding these budgetary or financial constraints. We continue to be able to attract the best students in Canada. We continue to be able to have hundreds of applicants for every one of our academic jobs, and we fill them with spectacular people. We have a great international reach and reputation. We're continually being asked to participate in networks of excellence and other things. So the university is not in terrible shape, so it's not a crisis. The university McGill is a very strong university. But we do have to face the fact that certain constraints exist on the resources that come into the university. So we're not right now threatened. In part, it's because other universities in Canada are also facing significant budgetary constraint at this time, whether it's British Columbia or Saskatchewan or just across the mountain at the University of Montreal or in Toronto, where the funding situation in Ontario is not very good either. So only about half of our operating budget actually comes from the Quebec grant, but as I pointed out, they also control the tuition side of the equation, and without flexibility, that means they control close to two-thirds of all of the revenues that we get into the university. So we're asking them to be flexible with us. Give us some opportunity to raise revenues in a different way. We know that the government of Quebec is broke. We've actually not complained about that, that we're not getting our fair share. We think we're not getting our fair share within the system, but we don't think the system can get much more from the Quebec government. So we're asking only for flexibility to help allow us to help ourselves out of this situation. And again, I think that the advances we made in the sales of goods and services and things that are our core mission, the sale of educational offerings, is a good way for us to think about the future. If you have any, we'll go to questions in a minute, but if you have any comments, there is an email, McGillfinances@McGill.ca, and there's also a budget corner in the McGill Reporter that you can send notes to. I will stop there and take questions, comments, suggestions. I know you all have concerns, and I always face criticisms and complaints, so I'll stop there. And Michael DeGrappa is here as well to answer questions if you have them. Yes.
Yeah, first off, I just want to thank you for organizing this forum and allowing everyone to come voice their ideas. That's really important, I think. My question is, what are the expected cuts to the MELS grant, the one that supports many out-of-classroom learning opportunities on campus, and what the plan is for support units currently funded by it, such as the Arts Internship Office, for example?
So that was, you actually saw that from the other presentation. There is a cut to specific envelopes in the reg budgetaire. I wanted to point out, we get an orientation budget, and the internships was included in that orientation. We get the reg budgetaire, and they're out $1.4 million, basically, not coming in that envelope. Commitments have been made, and we have to work with Olivier Dienz to see how we can continue to support that. But it was a line item cut, and I think that's important. This is not, it's not as unrestricted a grant as we have been used to. And that envelope is now, a line item has been drawn through it. So we'll work to see what we can do. Yes?
As far as lobbying the Quebec government to allow for greater freedoms for McGill to operate as it needs to be, I understand that may mean increases of tuition for students, which that's fair, I think, as long as those raises are going to be going back to our university. But what's the timeline of expecting a conclusion or a decision from that type of motion?
I think that we're, you know, I'm on record for a decade of thinking that we needed to increase tuition revenues. But there's a decision that may have been taken a couple of years ago, which means that it's going to be very tough to get any real increases in tuition. But we also have, we're the university that has the greatest international reach. And in four programs, our international students have been deregulated, which is what we've been asking for. They're not on the Quebec grant. So international students in science, engineering, management, and law are not part of the Quebec grant. But international students in every other discipline are. And the biggest one is this faculty, arts. That's the building. So we're asking the government to give us some flexibility in deregulating those international students so that a larger portion of their tuition can stay with us and not be clawed back by the government. That makes a lot of difference. It would make a lot of difference to us. But we recognize that we're providing something to the government, to the ministry as well. So we're working to try to find a flexible solution that allows some portion of those revenues to continue to flow into Quebec while allowing us to keep a greater portion. So tuition deregulation is one way to go. Differentiation by program might be another. It's already differentiated in terms of the grant, but it's not in terms of tuition. We don't know what the government will do in terms of its funding formula, but we do know that by December they will have reviewed a study that was commissioned by the PQ government on the funding formula, and they may have some recommendations. We want, again, flexibility. We still need to accept public money in order to function, but more flexibility would be better than what we have now. Yes? Put your mic on, please. This way they can record.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
What are the implications of all this for the funding that comes from the VP Research Office for research centers and groups and so forth?
So we have allocated all that money at the beginning of the year, and they have been distributed. And so right now we're not in a position to pull them back because their commitments have been made. But we will have to see in January whether we can continue that commitment into fiscal year 16 at the levels that they're now at. It'll be for fiscal year 16, we'll look at that.
There has been rumors that the government of Quebec would like to abolish the program between France and Quebec. And do you think that this will have an impact on the number of international, like, students that, well, French international students that come to McGill, and do you think that abolishing this program will help McGill?
I think, so that's a really good, important question. There is an exchange agreement between Quebec and France, but it includes potentially other nations in the Francophonie that allow students from Paris to come to McGill and pay a tuition rate that's less than a student who comes to McGill from Toronto. So that's something that the government needs to think about. If the tuition fees for French students went up to the Canadian average rather than at the Quebec average, it would help the entire system, and we don't think it would have a major negative impact on enrollments. McGill has over 1,000 students from France who are enrolled, and it's clearly a very favorable arrangement. Excuse me?
I don't know if you can answer this one, but what will it take, like, for the government to actually abolish this program, or like at least rethink about it? Because, like you said, it will have a huge impact.
Right. The government is thinking about it. So, I mean, the government thinks about a lot of things. So it's thinking about it, and it has taken, and I think it's seriously under advisement, recommendations that this program be that a shift be considered seriously for fiscal year 16. But we don't know if it'll happen, and we don't know what other political ramifications it might have. But it is incongruous for many of us to understand how someone from France can pay less than someone from Toronto to get the same education. We had one here and then one in the back.
This has to do with what you mentioned about asking the government for flexibility. One of the problems that's been growing over the years is the compliance burden. It seems that the less money we get from the government, the less money we get from granting agencies, the more reporting they want on how we use those fewer dollars. That work has to be done either by administrative and support staff, or it gets downloaded onto academic staff. It has to be done by somebody, and it's a burden. Is there any prospect that we will be getting some relief from this compliance burden?
That's a great question, because it's really not fair to say that less money, but the smaller proportion of our budget goes to larger compliance and reporting mechanisms. We have to do an incredible burden of reporting to the government. For example, the grant we get from the Quebec government, as I said earlier, is based on full-time equivalents, a headcount, but it's also based on weighted student units, a activity base. So you have a certain number of students, and then they do different things. So if an art student takes a real laboratory science class, then we get the grant for that portion as if they were science. Conversely, if a science student takes a philosophy elective, we get the money for the science student as if they were an art student. So it's an activity-based budgeting. And think about this. We've got 26,000 undergraduates. They each take roughly 30 credits a year, right? 10 courses a year. So there are 260,000, almost 300,000 actually, course enrollments that have to be managed in the two semesters. Each one of those gets reported to the government to calculate our grant. So again, there's a little bit of, we do it on average, right? We look at what's gone on in the past, and we think that's a pretty good indication, but it might not be. Students may be cross-registering. In arts and science, they can certainly cross-register freely in terms of their programs. So we don't know exactly how many enrollments there are, but the government audits those and randomly chooses to select a given number of students and looks at every record and decides whether or not we should have gotten the grant that we claimed. I said earlier, this at the end of the fourth quarter last year, we got a big increase, a one-time only infusion, because they recognized the students who we had said we had were legitimate and taking those activities. The burden of reporting is real, and it does require administrative and support staff, but the one thing that all 17 or so, 19, I forget, rectors in Quebec agreed to in a letter that they sent, signed in common from the BCI, the the Bureau de Coopération Interuniversitaire. They basically said the first thing Quebec has to do is cut the administrative burdens that it imposes on all universities. So there is a recognition that it has to be done, and there is a common lobbying front, if you could use the word lobbying, on that. The back.
I was wondering if you could clarify what you said earlier about the request for further deregulation in terms of international student fees. And I was wondering if that meant that in your ideal scenario, McGill would be able to retain more of the proportion of fees paid by international students, or whether McGill could set higher rates for international students and then retain those. Thank you.
So it's a combination of both. So you're absolutely right. Right now, we don't retain all of the international tuition that we collect because the government claws it back to the Quebec levels and then treats the students as if they were Quebec students with a grant, and the net is a flow of revenue from McGill into the system. So for international students. So if we deregulated all students by origin instead of by the country, the program of study, then those revenues, or at least a significant portion of them, would remain with the university. But we recognize that we contribute to the system, and so we would have to have some, ourselves, willingness to compromise on what that would be. We already get to set some of our own tuition rates for the deregulated programs.
Can you please clarify how much of the surplus from the fiscal year 2014 budget was allocated towards paying down McGill's accumulated deficit, the debt, and why that amount was allocated towards this given our current budget challenges?
It's $3.2 million or $4.3, and it all goes there because we have an accumulated debt, and when you close your books, it just gets added to the bottom line. You can't use it for anything else.
Yeah, so given that there is ongoing mobilization against austerity measures in education at other universities in Quebec, which are mostly led by students and employee unions, but also have some support from the administrators, such as that letter in Le Devoir, for example, by rectors of universities, my question would be, why does the McGill administration take such a fatalistic stance toward the financial situation of the system as a whole, particularly like looking to financial year 2016 and beyond? Like, is there any chance the administration would look favorably on those efforts and cooperate with them, like the administrators at other universities in Quebec have done?
I think we're trying to be realistic. The Quebec ratio of its accumulated debt to its gross domestic product is close to 50%. And that is European style, almost European levels. The average in the rest of Canada is half of that. So Quebec is burdened by a debt, and the government is trying to be responsible in reducing it. So we recognize that. We're trying to do it ourselves. So we recognize that they have a problem, and we recognize that they can't do everything to solve our problem without making more problems for themselves. So we would like to see flexibility. We would like to see a fair distribution, and we'd like to see higher education treated well in the government's budgets, but we know that they don't have a lot of money. So we're just being realistic about it. We're not fatalistic, we're just realistic. And the realism comes as well by asking them to give us the tools we need to be able to generate revenues that would help us fix our problem without it becoming their problem again. They have a problem, we recognized it.
Hi, this is really a tough situation, obviously, and I'm just going to read my notes because I'm a little nervous, but I'm just, I'm a part of the 2% non-instructional staff, and I understand I'm about to experience a 2% cut, you know, or the salary mass will, right? So I think you said 2% of the non-institutional staff will undergo a salary, you know, cut. And I'm wondering,
clear.
Okay, I'm nervous. Okay,
yeah, that's okay. Relax. Okay. It's not a cut to salaries. It's a cut to the overall mass.
That's okay.
So you can cover that in a variety of different ways. Right.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I just misspoke. Okay. So the salary mass, and it's going to be cut by 2%, and I'm included in this, right? My salary is included in a part of the salary mass, and you explained that this isn't a crisis, right? It's a serious situation, but it's not a crisis. But yet, in your part of your solution as how you're going to reduce this salary mass, of which my salary is a part of. You risk violating a collective agreement that's because we are allowed rematches in our collective agreement, and you cannot forego my salary increase. You cannot. So you present it as something that you might have to do because times are tough. But there's something called a collective agreement that allows us to be rematched due to the various changes we've undergone in our workplaces because of retirements. Our work is changing. And it's a legal document, so I don't understand how you can just say that you're going to have a second look at it. Or that you might be asking us to forego our pay increases because we have a salary.
So please, I did not say that. In fact, I said exactly the opposite.
Okay,
I said we have promises that were made and we have obligations we have to keep, and we're planning the budget to include all of the pay increases that were negotiated or promised. Well, you should have, because I said it. Okay. And with regard to rematches, it's a question of we need to look at the way in which we go about doing them, because they have been adding considerably to the salary mass without necessarily adding people. So, you know, there's some fairly large amounts of money that have been distributed on the basis of that, and we need to look at the way in which work is organized. It has nothing to do with the collective agreement right now.
The rematches are addressing the 256 positions that were in last October when our people left, right? So it's just making things fair. A lot of people were left doing a lot more work, and they should be paid for it.
Fair to ask people to do additional work without there being appropriate compensation. I said that. So I sometimes people only hear what they want to hear. I said that. So the issue, however, is we have to look at it carefully to make sure that we are getting the savings that we anticipated getting from the voluntary retirement plan. So we have to look carefully at our work organization. There's a project, My Workplace. There are other things going on at the university to try to understand how we can do without all of those people. They all were doing important jobs at McGill. No one doubts that. But we have a cut. We have to live with it. We have to live with it. That we're not making this up. You can read the Règles Budgétaires. That's what they say. So if they say that, the government, by the way, for the public function, as you all know, is threatening to do exactly what you said, and we've argued against it, which is to have special legislation. We don't want special legislation.
Perhaps this next question ties in well with the one that was asked previously, and I apologize if there's like overlap if any of these answers have been mentioned, but essentially what I'm wondering is, will all staff be taking a 2% cut, or will some groups with higher salaries, such as senior admin, be taking a greater load of
the burden? There's no implication. The only people who've taken a pay cut at the university over the last 6 years are the senior administration, right? 2-3% pay cuts. Nobody else took a pay cut. People didn't get pay increases. That's different. And I just said we're building the budget to give people the increases. But to give them increases, it means we have to find savings somewhere else. So we have to be careful about hiring more people. Because if you hire more people and they're also qualifying for pay increases, it increases your burden.
Okay. Yeah, sorry for that oversight.
Hi, I will speak from the point of view of a master's student at McGill. As an MA student in political science, I receive every month from the Social Science and Research Council of Canada $1,458, and my tuition fees for the whole term are $1,776. So that means like I have no debt you know, linked to the tuition fees. And plus, we have TA possibilities, research assistant possibilities. We have, when visiting scholars come at the Thompson House, we get free lunches. So honestly, in my budget, even if my tuition fees were doubled, I will still be able to make ends meet. So would you be able, you know, to close down your deficit if this possibility was put down in a referendum? I don't know.
Difficult. Again, tuition fees are totally regulated by the government. Some student fees can be put to a referendum, and we have had examples of that. And the students have been at McGill, compared to almost anywhere else in the country, have been very generous in terms of supporting those things that they think make a difference, and we agree with them, make a difference to their education, things like the Library Improvement Fund. Those are really important contributions. Individually, you know, doubling of the tuition would still leave us at about only 3/5 of the Canadian average, so even if it doubled. But people took to the streets over increasing by $500 a year for 5 years in a row the tuition rates, which would have brought us after 5 years to 60% of the Canadian average then. The Canadian average has also been going up, although there are rebates in Ontario. So tuition is a delicate matter, and we're not here to ask for liberalization of tuition fees. We're asking the government to give us a little bit of leeway on some things. But I appreciate your intervention, and I think it was a very good one. Thanks.
My question falls under the category of concern. I think that deficits and budget cuts often impact the most vulnerable. And this lady spoke to those who are covered by collective agreements and the legal ramifications associated to their salary increases and so forth. Whereas we know that managers at the university are more vulnerable because they are not unionized, but rather covered by an association called MUNASA if they choose to be members. So my question is, with the budget cuts and the impending deficit, how will this affect managers in terms of the economic increase and merit in the upcoming year?
So I will say it for a third time. We're building the budget on the basis of having to meet the promises made and the expectations that people have. We don't know what all the revenue streams are going to be look like. And in order to meet those increases in salary for those who are presently here, we have to restrict their numbers. Right? That's why we're putting a freeze in effect on hiring.
Yes. Hi. I just want to make a proposal that I think a good way for inviting people to make very specific proposals on how to cut expenses would be to make available the financial information about how money is spent in the different units and things like that, so people can be very clear on how and what to propose, because if we don't understand how the money is spent, it's hard to make a good proposal.
The budget of the university, as well as the financial statements for last year, are both on the web. They're readily available. Individual units, we don't budget to the individual unit level. For example, the budget of the university that I prepare goes to the faculties. Then the deans decide on a distribution to their units. We don't do that centrally. It's just there are just too many units to have that work like that.
Well, I'm not familiar with how that is done, but that's, I know that I can make my contribution by looking at how my unit expends the money, because I am familiar with that.
It's a good place to start, because there is an accumulation that goes there, and the individual units can make their finances visible to everyone there.
I have a few questions, actually. But the first one is a clarification. I understand that after the PR debacle over the 12 point something million dollars of a couple of weeks, you spent your time explaining what was really the intent of that message, or Michael or others in your office. But I'm still not entirely clear about it. I understand that the 12 point something was booked against our cumulative deficit. So it's a bookkeeping maneuver, but of course it stays in the fund. It stays in the pension fund. So that's not the issue. But one could have used the 12 point so million extra or unanticipated revenue from the pension fund. One could have used it as an occasion to rethink what to do about the actuarial deficit.
That will only be done next year. Michael might want to add, that will be done when there's an actuarial evaluation.
Uh-huh. But we have to wait until next year for that.
What happens at the end of every fiscal year, as the provost mentioned, after the year closes, is that we look at the assets of the plan and then make any adjustments on the gap side, the generally accepted accounting principles. So the $12.5 million that was referred to, that was after the fact. All we could do is reduce the gap liability. This is not money that we can spend. The fiscal year is over. Same with the $3.2 million surplus on the operations side. So all that does is go straight to the bottom line and reduces the finance. So
no, I understand that. I understand the bookkeeping side.
But every 3 years, we then look also at the liability side of the equation, and that's what leads to any changes to contribution rates between the employer and the employees.
So it's just a matter of there being a three-year period which was anticipated before we reconsider the 2.2% contributions.
What we said at the time was that if we felt that the situations had changed favorably, then we would trigger an earlier reevaluation, actuarial evaluation, and make a decision at that time. But although the asset side improved here, when we did a quick study of the liability side, we realized that, in fact, the overall situation in the pension fund had worsened from liabilities of some $97 million to $104 million deficit.
Uh-huh.
So okay. We wouldn't trigger that evaluation at this point. There would be no purpose.
So it just wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough to justify revaluation, reevaluation at this point. Okay, all right. That clarifies it. That would have been handy to know at the time. Two other questions. One, there is a lot of debate within the FQPPU, or not debate, but the FQPPU is very active in trying to. That is the Fédération Québécoise des Professeurs et Professeures de l'Université. MAUT is their counterpart here. They are proposing a reconsideration of the funding formula for the universities of the system, as you are aware, and their proposal involves increasing the importance of the number of professors in the funding formula rather than the number of students. Would we benefit from that, or would we get hurt by that?
I don't know the proposal that was made, but one of the things that McGill is often criticized for is having too many full-time tenure-track professors or full-time faculty lecturers. The sum of our full-time people is greater than it is anywhere else in the system, where they rely much more heavily on sessional lecturers to do their teaching. So I think in that sense, surprising that that organization would suggest anything that might benefit McGill. But you never know.
Well, we're a member of them, yeah. And maybe they want to please us. Last thing, with respect to the government requirement of reducing our administrative costs by 2%. Sure.
All of our administrative costs. In the envelope that was cut, right, the $15 million envelope for McGill, $2.3 million, $2.2 million in change was earmarked for two types of cuts, 3% to non-instructional expenditures, non-personnel non-instructional, and 2% on a salary mass that they had identified. We're contesting that because it seems ridiculous, but in that amount that they cut us were some of the payouts we made to people to take the voluntary retirement plan. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. We've actually already used that money to reduce our expenditures. And some of it was based on one-time only payments that had to be made to pay equity, which is a government mandate to begin with, and which we are fulfilling. So why would you tax us a second time on things we've already been paying? So we've written a letter of protest to the government on that, but it's not 2% of the whole salary mess. That would be huge.
Right? No, of a portion of the administrative. Yeah, okay, I understand that, but that raises the question. Once upon a time, McGill had a reputation for having the leanest administration of most of the universities, certainly in this province, but also across the country. Where do we stand now in terms of how heavy our administration is relative to the overall budget?
Across the country, we've done an analysis of the amount, number of VPs, the number of senior administrators at the university, and we're in the middle of the U15 pack. In Quebec, there's a very interesting accounting mechanism that goes on. If you're not unionized, then you're considered part of the administration. So when they did their calculation, all of our M's are calculated as part of the administration, which wouldn't happen at other universities. So there is a miscommunication that goes on sometimes in the press and elsewhere. So you have to be careful about how you look at that. A third thing to consider is some of the things we spend money on have to do with student life and learning, and it comes from student fees, which can be spent for no other purpose. When students pay additional fees to the university, and our students pay more fees than anybody else in Quebec, when those fees are collected, they're for specific purposes, like running student services, having athletics, having a student life component of residential life. Those positions are also counted against us, but we can't take them from anywhere else. We can't, again, take that money and use it for something else. So we are looking at ways of presenting the information that they will understand we don't have control over. So
But do we know where we stand net of those effects?
If you don't count the M's and you don't count
the student services?
We look a lot like most Quebec universities.
Which is not very good.
Oh, I didn't say, did I say that?
No. If you say we're in the middle of the pack of U15 administratively, we're not there salary-wise, obviously, in the middle of the pack.
No, but we had a plan to progress to being just above the middle. And if we can continue that by the end of 2016, we will be.
I'm just wondering if the hiring freeze would affect people who are on contract and whether or not they would get resubmitted next year.
It's not clear that we'll have the money for contracts that have to end dates, right? I'm sorry to be the bearer of that kind of news, but if a contract has an end date, then we have to reconsider whether or not the resources, if they're paid off of the 1A funds in particular, that's the operating budget that comes from the Quebec government and tuition. If they're paid for on the 1B through F funds and there's a revenue stream to justify it, then those contracts can be renewed. But it depends on what the source of your funding is.
When you talk about competitiveness for the in McGill, in its position for being able to attract top people or retain top people, it's not very reassuring to hear that one of the approaches is that everybody else is in equally bad shape, because that distribution for competitiveness, it's the top end that can move fairly freely and can particularly move to outside Canada. And so do you have any evidence that that is a concern and is becoming an increasing concern?
I don't have any evidence that's becoming an increasing concern, but it's always been a concern. When we do salary policy for academic staff in particular, we always have an envelope for retention, because we do worry about investing in people and then having them leave. So we do worry a bit about that. But we have looked at surveys that compare McGill to other AAU and U15 universities, and we have a lower turnover rate than most. So we are able to retain because of some of the things that we do. That doesn't mean we don't lose important people from that numerator of professors. One of the things that comes up in the rankings all the time, you may have seen one recently came out that showed that if the top 1% of citations. McGill was below seven other Canadian universities. I asked our group in planning institutional analysis to rerun that data with the top 3% and 5% of citations, and McGill jumps to second or third place. So what does that tell us? That this is the Canadian equivalent of Lake Wobegon, that everybody is above average, right? We have a lot of very strong professors. They get cited a lot. They're just not peaked in that 1% of citation networks. So, and we do worry about relative performance in the rankings, not because you don't manage a university to rankings, but when you see slippage of all Canadian universities in the rankings, you get worried. Not just one or two slots, but other universities inserting themselves in the middle. It's because of a very different resource base that has now been able to be brought to bear on their competitiveness that we don't have. So, you know, we think that we need more resources to run this university in an appropriate way for our own aspirations and our own history. We don't have it, so we're going to try to get it by getting more flexibility, and we support efforts to change the funding formula. We have our own proposals, which were made public in July of 2014. Actually, it goes back to July of 2013 when we made them public for the first time and submitted them to the commission that was the Tremblay-Roy commission that was studying the funding formula. And we think there are significant adjustments that could be made that would be both fairer and more equitable to everyone concerned and would rise the amount of money that's distributed by getting rid of special discretionary envelopes and doing everything in a more transparent way.
Yes, one thing that I'm concerned about and would like to hear you speak of is TA ships, which we have union and we're in bargaining right now, and I don't want you to talk about that, obviously, but as one of the earlier commenters pointed out, that's obviously a source of a good deal of financial assistance to students, graduate students, helps them pay the bills and the tuition, as well as being contributing to education, helping maintain that primary mission of the university of keeping the standards of education high for undergraduates. One thing we're concerned about, of course, is the prospect of hours being cut for TA ships. I don't know how much thought's been put into that, whether you have a good answer to that concern, but I thought I'd put it to you.
So for someone who wasn't bargaining, you laid out a pretty interesting table. We think that, you know, TA ships are an important component of graduate funding and of the quality of the education we offer. I don't think there's any debate about that. We think it's important. There are discussions about how much money we have for teaching support of any kind. And as the envelopes, as the budget actually gets restricted and that percentage that go to salaries goes from 65 to 70 to 75 and closes in local units at 90% to 95%, of everything that they expend, then you have to worry about, do we have the right mix? What can we do differently? So those things all have to be on the table. But it's not about a commitment to thinking about TAs as an important component. In the collective agreement, I agree to meet twice a year with the executive of the TAs to discuss academically oriented issues, not bargain, but to talk about the mission. So I agree, I think TAs are important. But we've moved our operating budget from having 8 years ago only $2 million of unrestricted grants to graduate students to $25 million. Actually, it's now closer to $30 million because we think it's important for graduate students also to have access to funding that doesn't tie them to hours of work and employment, but rather gives them an opportunity to complete their theses without having to work. So it's a balance. If we take it away from one, we could potentially give it to the other, but then we're taking it away. We don't have enough resources to do both.
Can McGill somehow increase the amount of money it gets from the indirect cost of research funding by negotiating, for example, with some of the funding agencies?
So indirect costs, the cost recoveries or indirect cost recoveries of research is an important topic. I pointed out that it is at McGill about $25 million just from the federal government. And that is generally divided, 75% goes to pay the bills, and 25% is distributed back to the faculties, not necessarily to the researcher, because it's indirect costs. It's the contribution that research makes. For example, we have to have a financial information system, we have to have a library, we have to have lights on, we have to have heating. Those are indirect costs that can't be attributed directly to a research project, because if they could be attributed directly, they would be a direct cost. And we don't bill back the faculties for those 25% that we redistribute back to them, but somebody has to pay the bills. The indirect costs we get from Ottawa have remained flat at about $25 million. But the amount of research that our professors bring in has been on a slightly positive slope. So why is the research indirect cost recoveries flat and the amount of research going up? It's the rate. 10 years ago, we were getting about 21, 22%. Now we're getting 17. As your research dollars go up, the rate at which the federal government reimburses you goes down. So that's why the dollar amount remains flat. So we can't turn back indirect costs to researchers, because they would then be direct costs, and that would be illegitimate from the point of view of the expenditures. If you get Quebec grants, they're now at 40, 50, or 60 cents on a dollar in terms of indirect costs, but they're put into the operating grant of the flat amount that we get to run the university. They're not available generally directly for redistribution. But since 2009, we've had 2010, we've had an agreement with the deans that if we take the average of the 3 years prior to 2010 as the baseline, any increases in indirect costs above that level will be given back to the faculties at 50%, not 25%. The problem is the rate goes down. So there's not, it's a great idea, except the formula is not generating any more money. We do the same for philanthropic gifts that generate salary support for professors and for increases in teaching that the faculty has to perform. So they're the same return to the faculties. Again, the Office of the Provost budgets to the faculty level. We can't budget down to the individual department level. There are over 120 units that have budgets, and that has to be fractalized, decentralized. Yes.
I have a question, comment about like how easy will it be for McGill to expand the portfolio of services that we offer to the private sector by using very specialized equipment like electronic microscopy and massive sequencing, things like that. I know that other universities get quite a good amount of money by doing that, because it's cheaper to do that on the university than in a private company. So I don't know.
McGill has professors who stipulate research contracts with private industry or with other government agencies, and they get, there's an indirect overhead that comes back to the university for those things. So it's not discouraged, it's just it can't interfere with the primary mission of the university, but if there are cycles that are free, then it can be used for that purpose.